Imagine a million-dollar robotics line.
Right, the kind of assembling car chassis.
Yeah, exactly. Moving with just absolute precision, swinging thousands of pounds of metal around. And then suddenly one of the massive robotic arms just swings completely out of control.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it smashes right into a safety barrier and brings the entire factory floor to this grinding, silent halt.
With all the alarms blaring, I imagine.
Blaring, yeah. And you, as the listener, you might be standing there thinking, giant hydraulic pump just blew out, or maybe a massive motor finally gave up the ghost. But what if I told you the real culprit wasn't on the assembly line at all?
Well, it rarely is. I mean, when those catastrophic failures happen, the root cause is often hiding in plain sight. It's
Yeah.
tucked away inside a, nondescript gray metal enclosure just sitting quietly in the corner of the factory floor.
The control panel.
Yeah, the control panel.
Right. Most people naturally focus on the muscle of an industrial operation, like the spinning gears, the heavy pneumatics.
Sure, it's loud, it's dynamic.
Exactly. But today, for this deep dive, we are prying open that heavy steel door to look at the nervous system. And here's where it gets really interesting. Because, you might think organizing the thousands of wires inside that box is just this mundane chore.
Like zip tying the messy cables behind your TV.
Yeah, just keeping things tidy, right?
Yeah.
But for these machines, that organization is the absolute secret to system survival.
It really is. It's the defining line between a system that runs flawlessly for 2 decades and one that inexplicably fails at 2 in the morning. Mastering what happens inside that box is really about taming this overwhelming density of information, power, and physical material within a highly constrained space.
Yeah.
And knowledge about this hidden infrastructure is most valuable when you realize how actively it is applied to keep the modern world running.
Totally. So your mission for this deep dive, and yes, we are taking you right into the trenches with us today, is to decode this hidden structural backbone of the industrial world, which is wiring ducts.
We've got a lot of ground to cover.
We do. We are pulling detailed, battle-tested insights from the absolute heavyweights of the industry. We're talking authoritative guides from Panduit, Phoenix Contact, Eaton, Schneider Electric, the NFPA, and Riddle.
All the big players.
Right. We're going to show you how something as seemingly basic as a plastic routing channel actually dictates a machine's thermal headroom, its electromagnetic performance, and how it prevents those million-dollar crashes.
Which is such a fascinating journey because it really forces you to look at electricity not just as this invisible energy, but as a physical mechanical force that needs highly disciplined traffic control.
Okay, let's unpack this. If you are standing in a factory and you pop the latch to open one of these massive control panels, what exactly are you looking at?
Well, at the most fundamental level, you are looking at a grid of wiring ducts. Depending on the region or, the engineer you're talking to, you might hear them called cable trunking, wire management channels, or raceways.
Raceways, right.
Yeah. Physically, picture long rectangular plastic or metal troughs mounted to the back wall of the enclosure.
Like little gutters almost.
Exactly like gutters, but they have removable covers that just snap on and off. Their primary job is to route conductors from the main power blocks to all the various components, like the relays, the logic controllers, the motor drives, in a really highly structured way.
So they are essentially the plumbing infrastructure for the electricity.
That's a great way to put it.
And if you've ever seen an older unducted panel, or maybe one built by someone who just didn't care, it is genuinely terrifying.
Oh, it's a mess.
It looks like a tangled bowl of neon spaghetti. If a line goes down at 3 a.m. and a technician opens a panel that looks like that, they're basically forced to play a guessing game.
Yeah, they tug on a red wire at the top left and they have to watch to see if something twitches at the bottom right.
Right, which is an absolute nightmare for downtime. The duct system replaces that spaghetti with a highly organized, efficient city grid. You have main vertical avenues, horizontal side streets, and distinct addresses for every component.
Exactly. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it goes way beyond just making troubleshooting faster for that technician. It is fundamentally about structural integrity.
How so?
While those duct walls physically shield delicate wires from sharp metal edges on the mounting plates, they protect the insulation from abrasion and, they keep wires from migrating into the spinning cooling fans of the larger motor drives.
Oh, wow. I didn't even think about the fans. But a city grid doesn't just have one type of road, right? You have multi-lane interstates, you have pedestrian walkways, narrow alleys, and inside a control panel, you have different zones facing entirely unique environmental threats.
That's right.
You've got intense heat sources in one corner, doors that swing open in another. So I assume you can't just buy 100 feet of one specific plastic trough and superglue it everywhere.
You certainly cannot. You need an entire arsenal of channels designed for very specific jobs. The most dominant type you will see, the real workhorse of the industry, is the slotted wiring duct.
Slotted, okay.
Yeah, it's typically made of PVC, and instead of solid walls, the vertical sides are made of individual breakaway fingers.
Basically, the walls of the duct look like a plastic comb, and you can just snap off one of the teeth to slip a wire out.
That's exactly the mechanism, yes. It allows panel builders to create an exit point literally anywhere along the channel. You run a bundle of wires down the main avenue, and whenever a wire reaches its destination component, you just route it through the slots.
That sounds super easy.
It is, which makes slotted duct the absolute standard for the control sections of the panel where the wiring is incredibly dense and where you expect frequent additions or component swaps over the life of the machine.
Okay, well, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second because I know how procurement departments think.
Oh, here we go.
If slotted duct is so incredibly convenient and lets you easily route wires anywhere just by snapping off a finger, why not just buy a mile of slotted duct? Save yourself a massive headache, get a bulk discount, put it absolutely everywhere in the panel, and call it a day.
What's fascinating here is that doing that would introduce entirely new failure modes into the machine.
Really?
Yeah, you absolutely have to use solid wall duct, meaning fully enclosed troughs with no slots for specific applications. Solid duct is mandatory for routing clean incoming power feeders, and more importantly, for runs that are highly sensitive to electromagnetic interference, or EMI.
Ah, I think I see where this is going. The convenient slots in the plastic comb. They're basically open windows.
They are open windows for electrical noise, exactly. If you are routing cables next to a massive servo drive, which is rapidly pulsing huge amounts of voltage to control a motor, that drive generates a massive high-frequency electromagnetic field.
Right.
If you use slotted plastic, that noise blasts right through the slots. But if you use a solid metal duct, you can utilize something called EMC bonding.
Hold on, EMC bonding. Walk me through what that actually does physically.
Sure. Electromagnetic compatibility. When you have a solid metal duct and you properly bond or connect that metal duct to the main grounding plane of the panel, the duct acts like a sponge for that rogue high frequency noise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The electromagnetic field hits the metal, turns into a tiny electrical current, and is immediately drained away to the ground before it can reach your sensitive sensor wires. You just can't do that with slotted plastic.
That makes total sense. So you're literally building a Faraday cage around the noisy parts of the highway.
Exactly.
And the source is also highlighted, flexible duct for the moving parts.
Right.
Because if you have a heavy steel door on the front of the panel with a bunch of touch screens and buttons on it, you have to get wires to that door.
Right.
If you put rigid slotted duct across the hinge, the moment you open the door, it just snaps in half.
Exactly the problem. Yeah. That is why corrugated flexible duct, usually made of nylon or polyethylene, is vital. It dynamically bridges those hinge points.
Yeah.
And on top of that, you have specialty channels like wide slot duct for incredibly thick power conductors that physically wouldn't fit through the standard comb fingers.
Oh, sure.
And low-profile duct for when you are fighting for every single millimeter of depth in a tightly constrained enclosure.
So we have our physical channels selected. We have the slotted alleys, the solid shielded highways, the flexible bridges. But now we need to talk about layout. Where do these roads actually go?
Right.
Because we are transitioning here from just picking a physical object out of a catalog to dealing with the spatial layout and really the invisible physics of electricity that you were just hinting at.
Well, the layout relies on a very strict grid system. The standard practice is to establish vertical backbone ducts running up and down the far left and right sides of the panel. Then you place horizontal ducts framing the D and rail rows.
Right. And for you listening, D and rails are just those standardized shiny metal rails bolted to the back plate where you physically snap in your components, like your relays or your terminal blocks.
Exactly. And the goal of placing the horizontal ducts directly above and below those rows of components is gravity and airflow. You want the wires to drop straight out of the duct channel into the component.
Okay, that makes sense.
You do not want wires crisscrossing the open air of the panel. Keeping the interior space between the components completely open drastically improves the internal airflow, which allows the cooling fans to actually do their job and pull heat away from the electronics.
But the most crucial rule in this entire spatial layout, the golden rule that kept popping up in all the engineering guides from Panduit and Schneider, is the separation of power and control.
It is non-negotiable. You must keep your 24-volt DC signal conductors physically segregated from your 230-volt or 480-volt AC power and motor circuits.
So they require dedicated, separate ducts.
Yes, or, at the absolute minimum, an internal grounded metallic divider running down the center of a single large duct.
So what does this all mean if you ignore it? Let's say I'm a builder trying to save some money and space. I run the heavy, roaring 480-volt AC line right bundled up next to the delicate 24-volt DC sensor line inside the same plastic tube.
Visually, it might look fine.
Right. From a purely visual standpoint, it looks very neat. But electrically, that is like trying to have a whispered, highly detailed conversation about a math problem while standing shoulder to shoulder with a blasting jet engine.
That's a great analogy.
Thanks. The whisper is your delicate sensor data, and the jet engine is your AC power. The whisper doesn't just get hard to hear, it gets completely distorted and corrupted by the sheer roar of the power line.
I really like that analogy, but let's dive into the mechanism of that roar, because it's not just noise, it's physics. It's called capacitive and magnetic coupling.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, when alternating current pulses through a heavy power wire, it creates a magnetic field that physically expands and collapses around the wire dozens of times a second. It's an invisible pulsing bubble of energy.
And if my delicate 24-volt sensor wire is sitting inside that invisible bubble?
Your sensor wire acts like an antenna. It absorbs that expanding and collapsing magnetic field, which induces a rogue voltage inside the sensor wire.
Oh, wow.
So the brain of the machine, the programmable logic controller, or PLC, might suddenly read a temperature spike from a sensor, but the temperature hasn't changed at all.
So the sensor isn't broken?
The sensor is fine. The PLC is just reading the induced magnetic interference from the motor wire you laid right next to it. You create a literal ghost in the machine just by putting two perfectly good wires in the same plastic tube.
That is fascinating. The components are working perfectly, but the spatial relationship between them is causing the machine to hallucinate.
Which brings us back to your robotics line crashing into a wall. If the position sensor on that robotic arm hallucinates because of magnetic coupling in a crowded wire duct, the arm moves to a position it shouldn't. Radiated interference can entirely derail a machine's logic if those layout rules aren't strictly enforced.
That's terrifying. And speaking of layout rules, we also have to touch on the mechanical physics of that door routing we brought up earlier. The guides were very specific about this. When you route cables from the static backplate to the swinging door using that flexible duct, you have to use a service loop.
Yes. You install strain relief anchors at both ends of the flexible duct, and you leave a deliberate U-shaped loop of slack in the cables.
Right.
Because that panel door might swing open tens of thousands of times over the lifespan of the equipment. The service loop ensures the motion is absorbed entirely by the flexible duct, so it never physically pugs on the delicate copper conductors themselves.
Makes sense.
Without it, you'd slowly snap the copper strands inside the insulation one by one until the connection just completely fails.
Okay, so we've built our grid, we've separated the screaming jet engines from the delicate whispers, we've protected the hinges, but now we have to talk about traffic density.
Right. Capacity.
How many wires can we actually pack inside these lanes? Because this shifts us from spatial layout to capacity, and it brings in some controversial math and thermodynamics.
It does. This raises an important question because the industry best practice for duct capacity targets a 50% fill ratio. Now, it is true that certain regulatory safety standards, like UL 508A in North America, will technically permit up to roughly a 75% fill in some specific scenarios.
Okay.
But seasoned panel builders and mechanical engineers will fight tooth and nail to keep it at 50%.
Okay, I have to push back hard on this one.
Yeah.
If you think about the real estate inside a factory, cabinet space is incredibly expensive. Factory owners want these control enclosures as compact as humanly possible so they can fit more actual production machinery on the floor.
Sure, I get that.
Leaving 50% of the duct completely empty sounds like a massive, unjustifiable waste of precious space. Are engineers just giving themselves a giant cushion to make their own lives easier?
I understand why procurement teams see it that way, but it is absolutely not a luxury cushion. It is about thermal survival. Think about wearing a heavy winter coat.
Okay.
If you are standing alone in an open field, your body heat dissipates into the air and you're fine. Now, imagine wearing that same heavy winter coat while packed shoulder to shoulder with hundreds of other people inside a stalled subway car with no air conditioning.
Oh, man. You would overheat almost instantly. The heat has nowhere to go.
Exactly. When electrical current flows through copper, it generates heat. If you pack a duct channel to 75 or 80%, you completely choke off the airflow around the inner wires. The heat from the bundle gets trapped.
Right.
And over a few years, that trapped heat physically bakes the PVC wire insulation. It becomes brittle, it cracks, and eventually the bare copper touches something it shouldn't, causing a dead short.
And on top of baking the wires, you also have the mechanical stress at the exit points, right?
Mm-hmm.
The bend radii?
Yes. Wires have to make a sharp 90-degree turn to exit the slots of the duct. If the duct is completely jam-packed, the wires at the bottom of the pile get crushed against the plastic edges by the sheer weight and pressure of the wires on top of them.
That makes sense.
But perhaps the most compelling argument for the 50% rule is the reality of field installation.
Because the panel is never actually done when it leaves the factory.
Never. When the panel is shipped and integrated at the actual facility, the local electricians almost always have to add field wiring, connecting the external sensors, the factory network cables, the safety interlocks.
Right.
If you ship a panel from the factory with the ducts already filled to 75%, you leave those field installation technicians absolutely nowhere to put the new wires.
And we all know exactly what happens then. The technicians are under a dying crunch, so they just grab a handful of zip ties, strap the new wires to the outside of the duct covers, and completely ruin the beautiful, isolated, safe city grid we just spent all this time designing.
Which introduces all those magnetic coupling hazards we just talked about. So let's actually run the math to show you how generous a 50% fill ratio really is. It's not as restrictive as it sounds.
Okay, let's hear it.
Consider a very standard 60 by 60 millimeter wiring duct. Its total internal cross-sectional area is 3,600 square millimeters. At our target 50% fill, your usable budget is half that, so 1,800 square millimeters.
Yeah, I've got that. 1,800 is our space budget.
Now, let's say you need to route 20 standard 1.5 square millimeter control wires down that channel. When you factor in the physical thickness of the plastic insulation around the copper, each of those wires takes up an area of about 7 square millimeters.
Okay.
So 20 of those wires creates a bundle that is 140 square millimeters.
Wait, 140 square millimeters total?
Yep.
If our budget on that 60 by 60 duct was 1,800, that bundle of 20 wires doesn't even make a dent.
Yeah, it doesn't. In fact, that 140 square millimeter bundle would easily fit inside a much smaller 40 by 40 millimeter duct at only a 17% fill ratio. You would still have massive headroom left over for future expansion and heat dissipation.
Wow.
A very common amateur mistake builders make is running their massive power cables and their tiny control conductors through identically sized ducts just to make the panel look visually symmetrical.
Which is crazy because then you're starving the massive power cables for air in one duct and wasting tons of empty space in the control duct. You have to do the math and size the roads to fit the actual traffic.
Precisely the point.
So we've nailed the layout. We've done the math for sizing. But what are these roads actually paved with? We've mentioned PVC a few times, but it's clearly not just a simple universal choice. And here is where we transition from engineering best practices into environmental compliance and material science.
Right. Well, the default material across the majority of the industry is indeed PVC. It is highly economical. It cuts cleanly without leaving jagged edges that could slice wire insulation. And it is naturally resistant to most of the ambient chemicals you would typically find floating around standard factory control rooms.
So PVC is your standard everyday workhorse. But what about extreme environments? The guides from Riddle and Phoenix Contact spent a lot of time talking about places like food processing plants, pharmaceutical clean rooms, or mass transit like passenger trains.
That is where standard PVC becomes a liability, and halogen-free duct becomes absolutely mandatory. Standard PVC is fine for a well-ventilated factory floor, but if a short circuit causes a fire, burning PVC releases highly toxic corrosive halogen gas and thick black smoke.
And if you were in a closed environment, that smoke is a much faster killer than the flame.
It is a massive hazard. In an enclosed space, like a passenger train car, a subway tunnel, or a naval submarine, you cannot evacuate easily. The toxic smoke from burning plastic can be lethal in minutes. Halogen-free plastics are engineered to severely limit that toxic smoke emission and prevent the release of corrosive acids that would also destroy surrounding electronics. You also see high temperature variants specifically designed for panels that have to sit near radiating heat sources, like heavy transformer enclosures or braking resistors.
It sounds like choosing the material isn't just a preference. It's akin to getting a legal passport for the machine to operate in a specific jurisdiction. You can build a mechanically brilliant panel, but if it doesn't speak the specific regulatory language of the environment it's going into, it's useless.
That is the reality of industrial design. Regulators do not leave material selection to chance. Choosing a halogen-free duct in a rail application isn't an upgrade you select from a sales brochure. It is a critical, legally binding life-or-death requirement, and there is a thick rulebook enforcing this globally.
Yeah, the sources mentioned a whole alphabet soup of standards you have to navigate depending on where you are on the map.
You must match the standard to the region. If you are building a panel for North America, UL 508A is the absolute benchmark. It legally dictates the separation rules and the fill expectations we just covered.
Okay.
Sitting right alongside it is NFPA 79, which governs the electrical safety of the machinery itself. Mm-hmm. And you have NEC Article 409, which covers field-installed panels.
NEC 409 was the one that mentioned requiring short-circuit current rating labels, right?
Yeah.
Why is a sticker on the front of the door so important?
Because that label tells the facility engineers exactly what happens if a catastrophic fault dumps thousands of amps of raw power into that panel. The label proves that the internal components, including the physical ducting and bracing, are rated to handle that massive magnetic and thermal shock without literally exploding like a bomb.
Wow.
It is a critical safety guarantee for the people walking past it every day.
And if you're shipping this machine across the Atlantic to a facility in Europe or really anywhere internationally,
then you throw out the North American playbook and operate under IEC 602 or 41 and IEC 61439.
Oh, totally different rules.
Exactly. These are the international and European benchmarks for machine safety and low voltage switchgear. They mandate incredibly similar disciplines regarding cable selection, enclosure rules, and routing practices, but the testing methodologies differ. Ignorance of these codes creates massive financial and safety risks. If you build a panel that violates the local standard, the local safety inspector will simply lock it out. The million-dollar machine cannot be turned on until it is rebuilt.
So stepping back and looking at everything we've uncovered today from these industry guides, what we've really discovered is that wiring duct layout isn't just cosmetic trim added at the very end to hide a messy job.
Not at all.
It is a first-class design decision. It fundamentally dictates the thermal survival, the electromagnetic sanity, and the long-term serviceability of the entire system.
It is the physical manifestation of discipline.
And honestly, for you listening, whether you ever find yourself wiring up an industrial electrical panel or not, this level of invisible structural discipline is incredibly relatable. When you think about how these engineers meticulously separate the loud, powerful signals from the delicate, quiet ones so they don't corrupt each other, it makes you think about how you organize the complex systems in your own life.
Right.
Whether that is the architecture of your data, the workflows in your project management, or even just how you physically lay out your desk. Deliberate structure isn't just about looking neat. Deliberate structure protects the integrity of the work itself.
That is a powerful way to frame it. It forces you to respect the environment you are building. And as we wrap up, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over, especially as technology accelerates. Right now, as we've discussed, a modern control panel is largely defined by these massive physical wiring ducts carrying hundreds of discrete copper signals. But across the industrial sector, we are currently seeing a rapid, aggressive rise in wireless industrial components. We have wireless sensor networks, 5G-enabled motor drives, Bluetooth logic controllers.
Oh, wow. I see where you're going with this.
If the underlying signal logic eventually goes entirely wireless over the next decade, what happens to the control panel? If the strict necessity to physically segregate hundreds of 24-volt copper control wires simply disappears into thin air, how will the very anatomy of these massive industrial machines fundamentally transform? Will the gray box in the corner shrink to the size of a shoebox? Will the wiring duct become a relic of the past?
That is a wild thought. That rigidly organized, perfectly mathematical city grid of slotted PVC ducts might just vanish, replaced by invisible radio frequencies. But until that completely wireless future arrives, the next time you look at a massive roaring industrial machine or a robotics line seamlessly building a car, remember the real magic keeping that system alive isn't in the spinning motors you can see. The real magic is hidden in the quiet gray box in the corner, navigating the chaotic energy of the system one perfectly straight, perfectly spaced plastic channel at a time.